first service I said Elaine, and then Kiatet was like, Dave, it's Alain Animal. Or, I don't know what she said. She said something. I'm like, I'm not saying that. She said, that's how you say it in French.
Yeah, it's true. She knows.
And I'm like, she says, it's not Elaine, it's Alain. Like, his English name would be Alan.
Alain.
So to say Alain. I'm like, see? I can say Alain.
Learning something new every day.
So I said Alain's
I love when you
service.
Pause and you're like, this this person's name is Alain.
Yeah. His first name is Pause, and it's Alain. A robot. Alain, my man.
Alain.
That would be great. All right, welcome back to Still Processing. Fourth weekend, this identity series, Losing Self, Knowing Self. And
Jess is here. Mike's here.
Jess is here.
I'm
Mike
here.
Is here. Kayla's producing.
We're doing it.
And we have a gnat problem in this podcast studio. So our
can't hear it, but they're here.
Our creative team wants to make this room very homey. So they brought in a bunch of plants, and now we have a gnat problem.
Yeah.
And it's a real problem.
You so can't if you see hear it, but we're waving them off.
If you hear someone like a clap, it's not because we're clapping at someone else what they're saying.
Since we're killing gnats.
We're killing gnats live. All right. So I think I've been, you know, the thing I've been processing is I've been able to kind of not be traveling during this series. And so I'm able to have a lot more congregant appointments and the stuff that is coming up for congregants as they are in this series. And this, I'm not surprised. I don't even know what the word is, but I always feel like I wish that I was able to meet with more congregants in the things that they're actually dealing with in their lives, because there's so much of this kind of stuff that's happening. It's a lot of it is like not just identity, but identity and group identity and relational brokenness and how you find God in the middle of that. So I think the thing I'm processing is how people have been processing this. And that's kind of the thing I've been sitting with. And obviously I'm not going to talk about what these counseling appointments have been like, but for me it's been getting down to that pastoral granular level of like sitting with people. So it's not just like quoting this, like whoever, you know, it's just like with people, like how does this work?
Yeah, you get to be sort of the prophet on Sunday mornings and then priestly, you know, during the week. And
yeah.
It's fun. It's one of the joys of pastoral ministry that you get this like sort of stratified view of how God is at work. Mm-hmm. Like you get to have five congregant appointments where people come in and you talk with them and you get to see like, oh, God's doing this kind of thing with a bunch of different people.
Yeah.
But any one person would not be able to see that. It's kind of one of the blessings of being a pastor.
Yeah. It's really cool.
Yeah. I feel like when you just said bunch of pastoral appointments, I think when we have a topic like this, it gives, and we're offering some pretty vulnerable, intimate parts of either our own journey. Like I feel like Dave, you even alluded this last Sunday of like, you're like, I used to be this kind of person that was like, knew so much about God, but like was very dangerous because I was not self-aware.
Yeah.
And so I feel like if anyone could ever see or be a little fly on the wall of our like pastoral appointments lately, mine have been like people just really willing to go very intimately, very deeply without very little like, and they're self-aware people, but it's just very little like small talk at the beginning. It's just like going in like for it. And I love it. But then also sometimes you're like, okay, this is not really how normal people like usually make friends. But I think one of the things that you're like, oh, I really like value pastoral roles for people who are very self-aware in those appointments, because you're like, they're really learning. They're really trying to digest all the things that are happening in their life and that they're questioning, and myself too, you know? So
it's, it's a sign of trust when a member of our church comes in and they can be vulnerable with their pastor, one of their pastors.
Yeah.
That's a joy and a sign of health, you know? And then I think the other part is they're understanding something deeper about God's grace. And maybe that's the process for all of us, is that you understand something deeper about God's grace so that your pretense and your need to perform before God sort of goes away as you, as God's saving work in your life goes deeper in.
Mm-hmm.
You have less pretense, less need to pretend or perform or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good point.
I mean, it reminded me of, we were talking about this right before we started, of like that quote you gave from the sociologist, which we
Alan.
Yes. And where he talked about guilt and discipline versus responsibility and initiative. Mm-hmm. And for, I feel like, gosh, I
Will am, you restate the point? Because I'm missing a little bit of it.
I'll just read the quote.
Yeah.
Read the quote.
Read it from Alan.
Yeah, he says, and by the way, he uses the word depression. It's a clinical book on depression.
Yes, yeah.
And I walked off of the stage on Sunday, and David McKinney typically does call to respond or someone for the prayer team. And he had this really beautiful, like, I started with depression, and then he kind of did a call to respond in and around that. Mm-hmm. But I told him, I hardly ever bring up clinical depression and, like, the clinical side of it in church because it's so, like, people get, I get afraid of, like, stepping over the work that they're doing with their therapist or the work that they're doing or the work that they're doing with their psychiatrist or whatever.
You're not trying to play pop psychologist.
Yeah. And I think I've been a pastor long enough in the therapeutic, like, all millennials going through therapy long enough to know that, like, that depression and the research coming out is, like, a lot of our depression is not curable simply through medication. Sometimes that's the worst thing, and or therapy, because therapy can be very self-focused. Mm-hmm. It happens through a losing of yourself, but it's not a cure to all depression. Mm-hmm. But
that word is so used in so many facets.
So many facets.
When you comment on it from one frame, somebody who's interpreting it from only a clinical perspective would say, well, that's a misstatement. And there's a sensitivity there.
Yeah, we have people in the medical field, a lot of them in our church. So I know that when I'm saying that, I'm talking to people that are, like, super smart and PhDs and they're doctors and blah, 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 blah. I know that. But anyways, here's a French person. Alan saying this. He says, in the book, The Weariness of the Self, depression is particular since it marks the helplessness of existence, be it expressed through sadness, fatigue, inhibition, or the inability to initiate action. The depressed individual, caught in a moment with no tomorrow, is left without drive, bogged down in a nothing is possible. Tired and empty, restless and violent, in short, nervous, we feel the weight of our individual sovereignty. So the whole point of his book is that depression is actually is us getting detached from a traditional way that we do identity, which had its own ubiquitous pathology. I think some psychiatrists called it a hysteria. It's like when you couldn't take the weight of responsibility from the traditional identity culture and you would just lose your mind because you just couldn't do it all. Mm-hmm. And women experience that more than anybody in that culture because men can go fight wars and go do farm work, and then women didn't know, like, how do I live into this thing as a woman? So that's different research. When you move to a modern identity structure, what Alan is saying is that and this is Charles Taylor too. It opened up a whole new vista of pathology
and freedom,
and it's because of freedom,
like an abyss of freedom. Yeah.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So he says it's depression, like that is the thing. And so the quote that you're talking about, he said, he calls it a collective path. Depression is a collective pathology. Depression is the pathology of a society whose norm is no longer based on guilt and discipline, which is traditional, but on responsibility and initiative, which is modern. Mm-hmm. And I had to unpack those words because, well, we're modern people, so we're going, guilt and discipline sounds...
Yeah, like, that's the worst.
That sounds like horrible. Responsibility and initiative, heck yeah. That is...
That's what I can do.
And that proves this is the...
That's our point.
And that responsibility and initiative is the cause of the pathology, the depression as a pathology in our culture and society. This is his clinical book. This is his work on it. Yeah. And so I was quoting that.
I thought it was just such an interesting frame to say. It was almost even scary to me when before you even like, people are totally down with initiative responsibility. I was like, yeah, I'm totally down with this. And then as I was thinking that, you were like, everyone's thinking of this. And I was oh my gosh. Like, I have to do some work, like, decoupling a bunch of things. But I just thought it was, just articulated, I think, a lot what people think If they hadn't been really having words to put of like what it is about my self-drive and the modern philosophy of that, of like, I got to find myself. I have to like prove myself. I'm going to show what I'm about. Or like, Mike, you'd mentioned something earlier about like your resume, like before God. And I was like, yeah, we just try to bring all the things that God already knows about us. Like, why is it impressive for me to bring the things he already knows? And so I think it's me understanding even a level of grace of that God has for me too. Mm-hmm. So.
So it seemed like some part of that quote is sort of even defining the waters that we swim in, mm-hmm. and the experiences we have around our own identity and why I feel so tired.
Yeah.
Because I think collectively, in our efforts to throw off the traditional self, the traditional conception of the self and identity formation, we've jumped so far into what is clearly the most individualistic society that's ever existed. You know, we live in that right now. Like, if there's any pendulum swing to this kind of thing, we're on the far end of individualistic to collectivistic, you know? Mm-hmm. And so we swim in those waters where we say, yeah, it's my responsibility to maximize myself, to perform, to change the world as best I can, to find a vocation that's a perfect fit for my Myers-Briggs Enneagram, StrengthsFinder, mm-hmm. disc profile.
Yes.
And so I have to maximize myself, and there's an incredible amount of pressure. You know, once you find the right vocation and you feel like you need that to have a perfect identity, then you have to move on to sort of finding the right love relationship. And most people only open themselves up to finding the right love relationship after they've secured a career. And it's sort of like, it's just very weighty. It's hard to swing. Mm-hmm. You know, obviously we've collectively said there's problems with the traditional self, and yet the modern self is just fatiguing. And I think that's, I don't know the relationship between that burnout and depression, but there's something there that many people feel, maybe myself included, you know?
Yeah, I think, and so maybe if people understood that when we teach on this, we're not trying to say, let's move away from traditional and modern identity, and they will no longer have any role in your life. This is your life. This is like your water that you're swimming in. I think what we're trying to do is point it out. And there is for pastors, there's gospel kind of opportunities in both of them, where maybe in a traditional culture, you kind of had a sense of morality and duty and right and wrong. And so I think Timothy Keller's language, like you're rearranging furniture for them and trying to get it to fit to go like, here's how you rearrange that around God. Mm-hmm. And then in a modern culture, it's just the pressure and the burden and the burnout and the depression. And like, you can't, every single time that you think that you've got above all that and you've made a self and you've done the thing, you're so afraid of it going away. And so you're just keeping, you're like, whatever got me here, I have to keep.
That's the name of this episode.
The hamster wheel of death. And it's the pressure.
And the invitation there is like, there's a beautiful gospel invitation in there, and that Jesus says, you know, all who are, you know, weary and heavy laden, come to me and you find rest for your souls. And so there is that, like, I think that's the only time in the gospel that, that Jesus, there's something about that. Well, anyway, it doesn't matter. There is a book that anyways, cut this part out. Anyway, so there's an invitation there, and there's an invitation then to take that and then how do you rearrange your life in such a way where that you can live into this world and not be like you live into it like a kind of like a citizen of this world and obviously the kingdom of heaven, but you live into it where your identity gets rearranged around your identity in Christ. Mm-hmm. That takes a lot of work. This takes a long time. I think that's the thing I was trying to say the most. Oh. This is going to take a long time, and you'll be doing this journey for a very long time. But it's not a journey that will burn you out. It's a journey of discovery that you come into more and more of yourself, and it's more of like illumination. Mm-hmm. It's like enlightenment. Mm-hmm. It's that sort of thing. It's like, wake up, O sleeper. It's that sort of journey versus the journey of like the heavy, you know.
Yeah.
I think what comes to mind with your scripture reference about Jesus's yoke being easy and the burden light, you know, the yoke is like agricultural thing that you tie onto the back of an ox or something like that, and they pull grain and stuff. And in the modern West, we live in a time where it's like submitting yourself to God or to anyone else is sort of feels so restricting. Mm-hmm. And it seems like the point that Jesus is making there is that you will be submitting yourself to something.
Yeah.
If you choose to submit yourself to me and yoke yourself to me, tie yourself to me, apprentice with me, work with me, you know, however mm-hmm. you describe that, the burden in the end will be light. Mm-hmm. And I think that's part of the process of sort of like trusting Jesus enough mm-hmm. to say, okay, I'll tie myself to you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then seeing the result of that, you know, live out in your life. So there's like an initial, well, I don't know if it's an initial step, but obviously that is the case when you become a Christian, mm-hmm. but every issue that comes up in your life, you have to sort of re-yoke yourself to Jesus in those areas. Mm-hmm. And then you obey God, and then you see him be good in your life in the midst of that obedience. And then you see something new about yourself and him as it, and that's that cycle I think of like mm-hmm. going deeper with Jesus and him being good in all these different aspects of life. Mm-hmm. But each time there's this like step to go, I'm going to choose to like I believe, help me with my unbelief mm-hmm. kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Like I'm going to choose to say I am who you say I am.
Yeah.
And you are who you say you are. And I'm going to live into that through obedience. And then, but it's only through like actually obeying God that you start to see him be good. And that if you didn't do that, mm-hmm. then you won't see that. So there's like, there's practice in it, but it's not just yeah. practice, it's trust. And it's not just trust and it's belief as well. So that's yeah. sort of how those things play together, it seems like.
Yeah, that's good. I feel like I loved the play out of Peter's life. I feel like people don't remember Apostle Peter, like about how, gosh, I love him because he's so flawed. Like he's flawed. He's so impulsive. And I think I remember when I first learned that he would just be like, I'm never going to deny you, God. Like I talk to God like that even now. I'm like, I'm never going to do that. Yeah. And then I'm like, what happens the next minute? I do it. And I'm like,
oh, you're both
gosh.
Ready, fire, aim people too.
Yes,
like,
exactly.
You are a little bit like Peter in that, right?
I love Peter. Yes, I love he's flawed, but he's okay with his flaws too. So he's just like all in. He's like, he doesn't, you know. Yeah.
What kind of idiot would deny you, Jesus?
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
You know, a day later.
I was like, oh, sorry, you know.
What kind of doofus?
But I've been thinking a lot about your concept where you were like, nothing was unseen in Peter by God. But there was something hidden in Christ that Peter needed to adventure with God for that. And that whole concept that I'm thinking about of like the unseen, the hidden, that isn't meant to be scary, but almost is like, it's kind of along the illumination, but it like intrigues you to be like, what is it that is in God that allows me to like uncover more about my life and myself?
But I think that, that's the thing that your point, Dave, you can speak for yourself here, but I think Dave's point was that there's something about what Peter missed. There's something that Peter missed about himself.
Oh, yes.
In that. Like he was not self-aware in that moment about the depth of his sin or the nature of his issues.
The pride too, where he thinks he just knows himself. He's like, I'll never do that. And I'm like, I literally started like getting red, being like, that's just me. Like literally happened the last week when I was like, I'll never do this. And I was like, I'm so sorry.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think the like parallel point of like the more you learn yourself, the more you learn God. I think it's so apparent in life of Peter because, like, I don't know if he really understood the forgiveness of Jesus or the love of Jesus or the kindness of Jesus, or you know the passage that we were just talking about, like Jesus saying that I am gentle and humble in heart. Mm. Like he probably had heard that because he was there when Jesus said that. But he didn't know that part. It was knowledge in the sense of information, but it wasn't knowledge in the sense of like lived experience. Like, mm-hmm. But the only way you get the knowing knowledge of God is through there's a depth of learning yourself. Does that make sense? So he had to learn his own fears to learn God's power and strength over fears. Mm-hmm. He had to learn God's forgiveness through exploring the depths of his own pride. Mm-hmm. And it was the only way to uncover it, you know? Sometimes that's what it's like, mm-hmm. sadly. We kind of want to read this stuff in a book or hear it in a sermon, but the lived devotional, that comes at the highest cost, but that's how you learn yourself and learn God. And I think it takes a deep commitment. I think Peter did make a commitment to Christ, like, where else are we going to go? Like, you have the mm-hmm. words of life. And at that moment of the denial, I mean, I think a few things were going on in denial. I think one of them, he was disillusioned by Jesus. He thought Jesus was this one thing. Mm-hmm. And then seeing Jesus humbly allow himself to be beaten after he saw Jesus overcome wind and waves and demons. Mm-hmm. He's like, I thought I knew you. I don't know you. Mm-hmm. I don't know that man. Like, I don't, that man that's right there, I don't know that man. Mm-hmm. I think there's some of that happening, like disillusionment. I think there's tons of fear and pride. Mm-hmm. All of that stuff is in there. And it was in there and it needed to come out, you know? Mm-hmm. And then, so that, I think that's the, that's how we learn. That was a good case study of how we learn God and self, or self and God at the same time. I think that's what all those quotes I shared at the beginning,
John,
you know,
Calvin and
I think it's all tied up because you don't really know. Like, you learn the depth of God's love by you needing the depth of God's love, learning yourself.
It is a little bananas that, like, Augustine and John Calvin, centuries apart, agreed on the, said the same thing. You know,
like
when those two agree, you got
you're
something.
Like, oh, yeah.
I think David Benner, in his book,
The Gift of Being Yourself.
The Gift of Being Yourself was
I'm reading
such
it right now.
A great book.
Yeah. I read it on
so
the plane.
He's the one that pointed out the, he does the whole life of Peter that way. Yeah. In a chapter. It's just really good. And I just did like 2 points. But you can take that through anyone's life, but you take that through even through Paul's life. But Peter's probably the starkest in the Gospels, you know? I think it's like that on purpose. Mm-hmm. But David Benner points out that this was an accepted part of our Christian heritage and faith, no matter if it's Orthodox, mm-hmm. The Eastern Church, the Western Church, mm-hmm. and it has just got buried over the last. Well. And he doesn't explain why it got buried, but it's like it just got buried. Like knowing God, knowing self, and knowing self and knowing God, that was just accepted knowledge of mm-hmm. the church. I mean, so
somehow got overlooked over the centuries. Mm. Even the part where I think the most impactful part was when, you know, he sees Jesus again for breakfast and doesn't say anything.
Yes.
And I'm like, how humbling.
Powerful, yeah.
How
that's
powerful.
That's crazy, huh? That's always...
Like, that's if I always... when I witness forgiveness, a reconciliation in my own life, and I think everyone, they have every right to be mad or every right to be, like, not forgiving me. But then they just don't say anything. And it's forgiven.
And not in a passive-aggressive way.
Oh, yeah, totally. Not in a passive-aggressive way. Yeah. But how humbling, which I feel like your whole like point about the experience of that, it's costly to be mm-hmm. vulnerable with people to experience something like that. Whereas if I just read it in a book about Peter, I don't think I actually understood that until I experienced forgiveness or reconciliation.
Okay, yeah. Two things. One, Jesus does the same thing that the prodigal father does to the prodigal son.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
Doesn't hear his apology.
Lavishes love on him. And it's insane. It's crazy.
Yeah. Mm.
That God loves us that way. Like, so he would look at Peter and just allow Peter to slowly pull himself out through these questions. It's just so insane. Yeah. But the other thing is that San Francisco, the congregation that we have, is so cerebral and intellectual.
Yes.
So they think they get it when they get it.
Oh, yeah.
And it clicks in their brain.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
But that is like maybe the beginning or maybe not even the beginning.
Yeah.
You don't know it until you live it. Mm-hmm. You don't know it until you're in that position where you have to live it. And I mean, a lot of people in our congregation don't really want to go through that.
You don't find out how deep that runs until you start getting into it. It's a little bit like when you become a parent and you start to realize how much you're like your dad, you know?
Yeah.
Where you're like, I thought I was a different person. And then I yell at my son just like my dad used to yell at me. Well, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
You know? So, but I did have a congregant, I think, intuiting what you just said, come up for prayer after the service. And they're like, I feel like I'm at the beginning of a journey that I'm not really sure I want to go down.
Yeah.
But here are the things I've obviously built my identity on as a young adult. I made it in school. I made it to a job that is respected in my area, like in my profession. I made it into a position that has a, you know, I don't know if he or she is C-suite, but he or she is saying, like, you know, I have a title that's pretty important, and I can tell that it has hardened me and made me a bit of a prideful and judgmental person. But there is something there that God does, I think, in flagging it, you know. But it was cool to hear this person sort of say, I can tell this is going to be a journey, though, for me to, like, unlearn this thing that has become so core to who I am, you know. Mm-hmm. And you know, just saying, I don't even know what to pray for, but will you pray for me, you know.
Totally. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, yeah, I would think we, the staff devotional I did yesterday, I mean, the I don't know, the staff, the stream of consciousness.
Yes, devotional or stream of consciousness, either one.
Some of the points, some of the devotionals have 3 points, some of them have no points.
Yeah, most of my sermons don't have any
just
points.
Just a
run-on
sentence,
It's just a run-on sentence. So that me processing things I was thinking is the whole idea of like experience or concept. Oh, and like we're a very conceptual people. So we think we get it when we get the concept, when we intellectually grasp the concept, where philosophically you don't really, concepts only can really follow experiences. Yeah. And experiences then you form concepts around experiences. You don't really get the concept until you experience the concept. Yeah. So that was my, I ranted.
But that tracks.
Or just like, then I went all kinds
moment,
of places.
Then you had a moment with a burrito that I thought was so funny. Yeah.
Breakfast burritos were involved in this. And I think most people, a lot of people, but our congregation especially, the concepts, they were taught that if you grasp the concepts, then you got it. You understand.
That is itself a mastery.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah. Even if they're complex concepts, I think there's even pride in grasping complex concepts of life, even intellectually or philosophically. And we think because it's so complex, it took up so much of my brain, it means I get it.
I think, yeah.
And we don't necessarily, that doesn't mean anything relationally or experientially.
It is
all.
Really poisonous for the soul. I mean, I think as a person who is a little more tempted to have that be the case, even in my personal life, like, I don't know that I have spent years of my spiritual growth trying to know myself so that I can know God better, you know?
Yeah.
And I definitely come from a Christian stream that does sort of say, like, here's the concepts and, you know, like, got to make sure you get those right to understand the Christian life. I'm losing track of my point. But outside of the fact that I resonate with that.
Yeah.
There is a different thing that unlocks when you actually start to practice it, you know? Yeah. I think you realize where you're at when you start to practice it. Oh, what I was going to say was, I think the real temptation for people in our congregation is that they will not honor the Lord with their decisions, but they will come back for prayer and go, why is there this roadblock here? Because they'll go back
wow,
to the
Mike,
concepts.
You are just going for it.
Well, I don't know. I don't know if I'm being,
I agree, if I'm pushing
too much. I'm just saying,
I
think the sense I get is that the cognitive type people are saying that my understanding of God's grace and of God's goodness will overcome my lack of practice and sort of like gritty obedience and trust in the Lord in the tangible stuff, such that I'll still have the like goodness of God changing my life, but not need to make the like tangible like sacrifices, you know?
Yeah.
Something like that.
The ethical stuff.
The ethical stuff, even the time management stuff, you know? Yeah. Like if I really zero in on the concepts, it will overcome my lack of practice.
Yes.
So if what I hear you saying is, and I think this is a good way of framing it, if I can get the concept of God's love, if I just get it conceptually enough, I don't have to then remain in God's love. I don't have to like experientially learn it through giving up mornings to be with God and spend time with God or the spiritual practices of whatever the spiritual practice is, or ethically live into A, B, or C, or D, whether it's like power, money.
Yeah.
I don't have to ethically live into that. I just know that God's love is there, and that's all I need.
Like that's the main way of getting God the other stuff. But you're a whole being, you know, and your emotions are so obviously tied to, as far as I can tell, it seems like your emotions are so tied to the habits that you form, what you devote your affections to, what you fill your brain with in terms of like media and all that stuff. Like we're holistic beings, and it makes sense that our like the way God works in our lives has to sort of like involve all of those things if it's going to treat every part of who you are. So,
yeah, I think a good question to ask yourself is, where is God at work right now to want to make you more like Jesus? Where is He putting His finger on? Usually it's like when you first do the Enneagram, it's the one that makes you the most angry and ashamed is probably your Enneagram type.
Oh, interesting.
And so where's that at God at work? It's usually the part where you're like, I don't really want to talk about that. That's kind of where God is
faces. I hate those kind of people.
Yeah.
I hate Enneagram threes.
Yeah.
Totally.
So, yeah, exactly. Like, And I say that because sometimes when you hear kind of like how you framed it, and I do agree with it, it becomes overwhelming. Like, yeah. I where do I even start? And do I start with like my like sex life? Do I start with like generosity? Do I start with like, okay, imbalance of power and whatever? Do I start with family of origin? Do I start with, people get completely overwhelmed. Mm. And, you know, the journey of Christian formation is obviously a lifetime. And usually it's like, where's that thing right now that God is like, that you know right now, if you were to sit before God, he's putting his finger on it. You're like, that is it. I don't really want to talk about that thing. I don't want you to talk about that thing. I don't want to be confronted on that thing. Chances are that's the place that God wants to do something with.
Yeah, Dave, that's a great next step, something very practical for us to discern together. And we have our last podcast next week for this series. So we'll see you guys next week.